Moore's University Forum. I'm Jean Moore, bringing you conversations with outstanding personalities on issues of interest to local, national, and international communities. Our topic today by telephone to Boston, Massachusetts, is a continuing conversation on AIDS in the life of my guest, Dr. Edward Revalinsky. Dr. Revalinsky is a brilliant academician. He holds a bachelor's degree in sociology and theology from Marquette University, an MBA in finance from Rutgers University, and a master's and PhD in the study of religion from Harvard University. He is the executive director of the Boston AIDS Consortium in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome back to University Forum, Dr. Ed.
It's wonderful to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great talking with you. We've known each other, since the mid-80s, but this conversation we're having is late because we started with the idea that after the first one you did at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and after a few other programs that we were going to do this every 2 years. But you got so busy, you know, that that we weren't able to do one for the last couple of years or so.
Yes, I am afraid we missed a couple in the cycle.
But I think that's great because you're very much alive. And I know you weren't so sure that that would be the case when we first talked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And although there have been a couple touch and goes since then, but keep going.
Well, let's talk first to some basic information for those who may not be as aware as we would hope they would be, is to what is AIDS and what does HIV stand for?
Well, let's start with HIV. HIV stands for Human Immune Deficiency Syndrome virus. And basically what happens is that there is a virus, and viruses are strange creatures. They're really not like germs. Germs that cause pneumonia. If you look under the microscope, you can actually see things that move around. Viruses are basically animated chemical particles, and they can reproduce themselves, but they don't do much else beyond that. In other words, they invade the host that they need for reproducing, invade the host, use the host's material, reproduce, and continue. They don't usually move on their own. They're spread by other means. And depending on what kind of virus it is, it can have different kinds of effects on the host that it lives in or on. Some long time ago, and actually probably the origin of HIV was way, way, way back in the 30s or 40s, and it's been located in probably the Congo region of Africa. And basically, it's one of those things, again, viruses are terribly simple creatures, insofar as they are creatures, and mutate very easily. I mean, we see this every year in the way the common cold changes and the flu changes. You can get a flu shot for 1 year and it's no good the next year because, again, things learn how to survive. Yeah. HIV probably started off in monkeys, probably chimpanzees, and people hunted chimpanzees. It's a blood-borne infection, and it also lives in particular organs, but most easily it's transmitted through blood. People butchered chimpanzees, may or may not have picked up the virus. The virus changes once it enters the human host, and then possibly will reproduce and possibly spread to other people. So that apparently is the story of what happened, and people say, well, if it was that early, why didn't we see more of it? Because, again, it was isolated. People who lived in the country would butcher the monkeys, eat the monkeys, possibly get infected during the butchering activity, were living in remote villages. One of the things that modernity certainly has done is to make people to allow people to move much more quickly, much more easily across vast distances. And also, after the Second World War, you know, there was a lot of migration. People go from the countryside into the cities. Cities are wonderful places for disease to spread. And that's apparently exactly what happened with HIV. So from, you know, the few kinds of infections that happened in small villages where it would spring up, die out, wouldn't spread, people migrate to cities. It is passed on in cities. People come and visit countries. It's passed from one country to the next country, and what you have is an epidemic. Probably the closest thing in the last 100 years or so was the great flu virus after World War One that swept Europe and the United States and just took people because, you know, there wasn't a lot of resistance to it. That's sort of the same thing we're seeing happening with HIV/AIDS. When HIV invades the body, it has particular cells that it likes to use for its own reproduction, and these are the white cells. And the white cells, as you may know, are those parts of the bloodstream that fight infection, fight other bacteria, fight viruses, and help keep the body functioning and hold off invaders. Well, HIV is very, very skillful in tricking the white cells, especially a particular white cell, 8, to allowing it to enter in. And what the HIV virus particle does is to say, let me in. It manages to break into the cell. It grabs the genetic material, the building blocks, from within the white blood cell, and then reproduces itself. Mm. It reproduces itself so fast and so efficiently that the white cell bursts and dies. Now, you can imagine this happening at a microscopic level, but constantly happening, because none of the white cells recognize it as an enemy. So effectively, what you end up having is the HIV eating up, for want of another image, all of the white cells that are able to fight infection. Once this happens, a person becomes vulnerable to very, very simple kinds of infections, things that we rarely ever see except in people who have very, very weak immune systems. So the first things that started showing up in the United States were strange pneumonias, PCP pneumonia, a very, very strange cancer, and these were clustered around particular populations, subpopulations, on the East Coast, on the West Coast, usually gay white males. The disease was associated with gay white males. No one knew how it was spread at that time, and it just started wiping out people. It was some years before the virus was isolated, and then some years after that, that effective treatment was developed, and treatments are continuing to be developed. In the meanwhile, many millions of people have died. The virus continues to spread, not only in the United States, although it's been slowed, but certainly, as we all know, it's ravished Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. It's certainly picking up with velocity in Russia, in the Baltic states. It's still very much present in Europe. It continues to be a major problem.
Now, when it gets to that point, we're talking about AIDS as the virus develops, and you knew that you had the HIV when you were working as a vice chancellor for finance at a large Midwestern university, right?
Actually, I got both diagnoses at the same time. And what had happened in my case was that I started feeling extraordinarily fatigued, and then I started developing skin problems and developed a welt on my arm that had no reason to be there. Someone suggested to me, you know, you really ought to have that biopsy. And so I did. I went into the Twin Cities in Minnesota and went to dermatology, and they did the biopsy of the welt. And I received a call back saying, I don't know, the physician saying, I don't know what your blood work would look like, but I would suggest that you have blood work done because the lesion has turned out to be Kaposi sarcoma. And Kaposi sarcoma is that strange cancer I spoke of just a few moments ago. It rarely occurs in ordinary people's lives. It's very, very uncommon. Before the AIDS epidemic, it occurred in elderly Mediterranean people. I'm not certain what the connection is, but that's about the only time it ever showed up. So at that point, that kind of a diagnosis, once you get one of these particular opportunistic diseases, and that's what they're called because, again, they're unusual and they only show up in very damaged immune systems, that's understood to be the diagnosis for AIDS, acquired immunity deficiency syndrome.
When you received that diagnosis, and I know we've talked about this some years ago, what was the prognosis at that point in time?
At that time, 3 years. Mm-hmm. So that was 1992. My T cell count at that point was 146. For the normal person, the T count will be somewhere between 1,000 and 800. Mm. So clearly, I was really running down very, very quickly. And at that time, you usually lost about 100 per year. So obviously, it wasn't a lot to hold out to. There were only a couple of drugs at that point, AZT and one or two others, which were effective for a while. But again, the virus outfoxes the medication.
Now, you moved then from Minnesota to Boston for some reason. What was that about? Did they have more information in Boston?
Well, in part, there was certainly a much larger experience base in the medical community in Boston. Again, fortunately, Boston is one of the very best centers for medical research. There are several teaching hospitals, and this is where first-rate cutting-edge research was being done. And also, the epidemic had shown up rather early in the Boston area. So, I mean, there is an experience base for dealing with the disease. Ooh. Also, I had gone to school in Boston. I had still had friends in Boston. Mm-hmm. And the summer and the winters are a lot less severe than they are in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. But now, you know, that's about the time around there when you sent me that resume that I asked for. And what did you send again?
Oh, and I also sent a copy of my soon-to-be obituary.
Mm. And that's because you weren't sure what was going to be happening and how soon, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. You did it, though, also, I think, when we talked. You mentioned the fact that it's a way of planning ahead that can make it better for others who are left behind.
Indeed. I mean, one of the problems in the early days of the epidemic was that one would be taken so quickly, and it was happening so much and so often that the community of care was terribly fatigued. People would pass without making accommodations or making plans for disposition. This was especially a problem in families when parents would either one or both, which was not unusual, would pass. What would happen with the kids? People who were infected and who were fairly well along the disease progression had to think about what was going to happen next and face it.
Yes. Now, did you believe that you had it? I know you're a very scientifically oriented person, among other things, as far as trying to get precisely to the back of whatever the situation may be. But did you believe that you had it, and did you know how you contracted it?
Well, I'm certain I know how I contracted it, and that was through male-to-male sex. When I'm not terribly certain. Again, the usual thought was that it takes 10 years. At that time, it took 10 years to show up, mm-hmm. To manifest the kinds of diseases that I started getting. I remember one point earlier on of having what I thought was a very, very bad cold. Actually, it was worse than a cold because it reminded me of having the mumps and the measles all at once, where, you know, lymph nodes were swelling in the neck and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a lot to do with that kind of knowledge. I think at that time, they hadn't done the test to detect at that point. And, you know, you just don't think about it.
Yeah. You're listening to University Forum with my guest, Dr. Edward Rybolinski, discussing on his life living with AIDS. You had to go through certain kinds of medical crises. You did go through a great deal of problems. What were some of the symptoms and the torture, actually, that you went through?
Well, 96 was a very, very bad year. At that point, I had lost a great deal of what was left of my immune system. Again, the CD4 count was no longer 146, we were talking about in the teens. And these are like so many cells per microliter of blood. I mean, very, very scientific. We usually just talk about how many cells do you have, to give you an idea. And it got to the point where only about 12 per standard measure were countable. At that point, I started experiencing more and more of the KS lesions, mostly arms, body, trunk of the body, throat, ear, started showing up on my nose. The physician was worried about, were they also happening internally? Because that can happen too, and that can be almost an uncontrollable occurrence. For example, they could show up in your lungs, show up in the digestive tract, and obviously, you know, that would impair and impede the ability just to do very, very basic life functions. That was happening. I also developed CMV, psychomegalovirus, which again is something that is out there and it doesn't bother normally healthy people. However, when again the immune system is incredibly depressed, it shows up. Well, it manifested itself in my eyes. And in my left eye, I started having repeated infection. It was very hard to control. I had to undergo infusions daily, three or four times a day, of ganciclovir, which is the one of the few drugs that works with CMV. It started failing. My vision continued to fail. But just at that point, one of the research physicians in Boston had undertaken a new study where they implanted small pellets in the eye directly that released on a controlled basis the ganciclovir. So it hit directly the target. That worked. It stopped the infection. However, there were all sorts of side effects to that. I had a couple of detached retinas. Laser surgery, then the cornea, the lens of my eye clouded over because of some of the treatment, so I had a lens replaced in the left eye. The eye is saved. I mean, it doesn't function terribly well, but fortunately, the CMV didn't show up anywhere else, and again, it could have been absolutely disastrous had it shown up in other major organ groups. The infusion created its own problems. I had a small metal box sewn into my chest through which there were two ports that I would do the infusion during the day. It got infected. Ended up in the hospital. Almost had kidney failure. They managed to check the infection, and I got through that particular hospitalization. Then, thank God, the first protease inhibitors came out, and I experienced what was called the Lazarus effect. I started a new drug and just turned around.
It's like raising you from the dead before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The KS went into retreat, the lesions disappeared, the CMV ended, no more PCP infections. I had several of those bouts I almost forgot to tell you about. And gradually just moving back to being on a fairly even keel.
About what year would that have been?
That was at the end of 96, going into 97.
Yeah. So the newer medications were beginning to come in then?
Right. And that's when also they started talking about doing cocktails. In other words, taking some of the older drugs that had worked for a while before the virus outfoxed it and mixing them together so that the virus would be attacked at all stages of its reproduction. You try to hit it at the beginning when it invades, you try to hit it when it's reproducing, and you try to hit it before it spreads to other cells. And that was basically the thought behind the drug cocktails, where you end up taking hands full of pills, each of which addressed control of the virus at various points of its life.
Were these sometimes medical trials, or were they difficult to get in terms of the medications?
In a couple of cases, I wasn't in medical trials. The medication was, probably will continue to be, extraordinarily expensive. I had health insurance through my university pension, and also, having survived long enough, I also had access to Medicare. That continues to be a problem with other people who don't have that kind of resource availability of just trying to get access to the medication and staying on it. Because, again, no matter where you are in the treatment process, you have to always take the medicine and you have to take it religiously on schedule. Otherwise, the virus will outfox it and you have to start with something all over again.
Mm. You must have been emotionally drained all the way through all of this, Ed. I know you have a great sense of humor. I always call you the most witty person I've ever met, and a wonderful vocabulary. But at what point did you begin to turn around what may have been very depressing thoughts to feeling that things might be really looking up?
I think it was when I didn't have to worry about the CMV getting worse and possibly going blind. And when the doctor said we can probably take out the metal box, the indwelling port, that was, you know, clearly a sign that things definitely had reversed and were going to get better and stay better.
Now, during all of this, while you were under treatment and everything, what were you able to do as far as interacting with the community and other people? Because you are a people person when it comes to trying to get things done. I know that from the years that we worked together.
Thank you. I served on the Ryan White Planning Council for a number of years, and I started that pretty early when I came back to Boston. But it got to the point, too, where most of my day was taken up in either administering infusions, going to doctor visits, or trying to stay awake, or trying to hold down food. There were times when I remember carrying around a small portable pump that delivered the ganciclovir. I had to take it so often that, indeed, if I was going to leave the house, I couldn't interrupt the schedule and would have to take the portable pump with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being in the pew once or twice with the pump with me.
In the pew?
At church.
At church.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was at that time, too, you know, it was clearly obvious that I was failing. And people came by and said goodbye.
Mm. So it was a little bit longer before you were able to turn it around even greater. At what juncture, then, did it move away from this looking towards a possibility of death to really looking up to continuing with life in a much more productive way?
I think it wasn't easy climbing back. I mean, it did take a good long while to feeling robust again. I mean, it got to the point where I felt well enough that I wanted more challenges. I wanted to do something. And so I decided, I guess it's time to go back to work.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2002, I told the university that I no longer require the disability, and cut that tie, and went back to work.
Now, we didn't talk much about how you separated from that first job in Minnesota and what happened there. Just briefly, remind me, what happened when you found out that you had AIDS and then felt you had to leave a very high-level position?
Well, after I attempted to digest the information for myself, because, again, it's one of those things where I received a phone call about the biopsy. Then the next month I was in the Twin Cities again for blood work, and the head of the AIDS clinic there told me, indeed, you do have the diagnosis, and here's your situation. And going back to this very small town of about 5,000 people, 2,000 of whom were the students, I went to my supervisor, the chancellor for the campus, and I said, here is the problem. How shall we handle this? His response was, we should talk about it openly. We should let the community know. Nothing should be hidden. I agreed with him. And tell people that I would be going back east for medical treatment. And so basically what happened was I first talked to my direct reports, broke the news, and then I sent a note around to everybody else. And it was picked up on a couple of the newspapers because I ended up getting calls from former students from all over the country. And that's sort of how it was handled.
Now, as you left and then started back now to feeling a little bit better after this long siege that you were under, you have been involved in a lot of different volunteer activities and then, I mean, paid activities now. talk about some of those and what's happened as far as the work you've done and some of the recognitions that I know that you have received.
Well, between working on AIDS-related stuff, I was on for a number of years the Ryan White Planning Council, as I had mentioned. I was part of the steering committee for the Boston AIDS Consortium, and when it became an independent, freestanding organization in 94 or 5, I was one of the incorporators and served in various roles on that corporation. Until, you know, a couple years ago when the executive director decided to go back to school to finish up his dissertation, I decided, well, maybe I should apply for it because no one knows the organization better than I do. So for the last few years, I've been executive director of the Boston AIDS Consortium. Mm-hmm. Part of the work I've done in the community has been recognized by, for example, AIDS Action when it used to do its community recognition of unsung heroes, sort of people in the background who do stuff and have an impact on the community. Been involved in doing a lot of other kinds of volunteer work for whatever parish I was belonging to at that particular time, fundraising, renovations, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I picked up a few things about you on the internet, but also some pictures I saw of when you were getting awarded for all that you've done as a volunteer, as well as some of the work that you did as a really fine resource person, because you must have gone through and found out all the different ways in which you could cope with this disease in a way also that it could help other people.
Well, again, you know, the old saying, to those to whom much has been given, much is expected, and I've always believed that very, very firmly. And, you know, I don't think one can do enough to give back. So certainly all of the gifts that I've enjoyed over my life, you know, show some appreciation for that. I try to do as much as I can.
Now, what did Ryan White stand for? What was that award?
Let me back up a bit. The Ryan White Planning Council, with which I had worked, is sort of the shorthand name for an organization that's required under federal legislation. As you may recollect, again, that you know we're in the 25th, 26th year of the epidemic. The first few years, there was no government recognition of the severity of the epidemic. Finally, through the work of a lot of people, the federal response to the AIDS epidemic was the enactment of the Ryan White Care Act of 1990. Mm-hmm. It was named after a teenager, Ryan White, who contracted HIV as a hemophiliac. Again, in the early days when people didn't know exactly how HIV was transmitted, people who have bleeding disease, hemophilia, received clotting factor. That is the element in the red blood cells that allows your blood to clot so you don't bleed, was given out, unbeknownst to the companies that produced it, tainted with HIV. And a lot of people who had hemophilia indeed became infected just because of the use of clotting factor.
Because of all that we haven't gotten to, we're going to have a second show.
Okay.
That will go into some of the more extensive information about and demographics about AIDS. I want to thank you so much for this interview on AIDS and what it has meant to you and what you have meant to us.
Thank you for giving me the occasion to.
Well, I thank you so much for being my guest on this program, and we're going to have a second show for next time.
Wonderful.
I'm Jean Moore. Please send your comments on University Forum programs and on our conversation with Dr. Edward Rolinski to me by email, jemoore@wrti.org, or call my voicemail, 215-204-4376.